Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Mario Ritter Jr. reports on Thailand's upcoming election after nearly 10 years of a military-led government. Faith Perlow has this week's Everyday Grammar lesson about memories and Mother's Day. Later, we listen to the next part in our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
Thailand will hold an election on May 14th after nearly 10 years under a military-led government. Voters will choose from opposition parties, including Pu Thai and Move Forward, or supporters of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. The 69-year-old Prayut is a former army chief who led a coup in 2014 to take over the government. Later, court decisions permitted him to stay in power. About 52 million of Thailand's population of more than 65 million can vote for members of a new 500-seat House of Representatives to serve 4-year terms. Voters have 2 ballots, one for a local representative and the other for a political party on a national level. There are 400 seats for winning candidates and 100 seats for the parties. Parties winning more than 25 seats can nominate a candidate for prime minister. Those candidates will be put to a vote by the legislature, possibly in August. The legislature consists of 2 bodies, the 500-seat House and a 250-seat Senate. Thailand's constitution was rewritten by the military in 2017. The Senate is made up of members appointed by a military group, and most have sided in votes with the ruling military-backed parties. To become prime minister, the winning candidate must have the votes of more than half of the combined legislature, or 375 members. Pu Thai is a political party controlled by the wealthy Shinawat family. It has a big lead in opinion polls, as it did in earlier elections. Thaksin Shinawat and his sister Yingluck were both former prime ministers. A military coup removed Thaksin from office in 2006. Yingluck's ouster came during another coup in 2014. They now live in exile, but Thaksin's 36-year-old daughter, Pai Tong Tarn, is running as one of the party's candidates. Move Forward is another opposition party with strong support. The party appeals to young voters. It seeks to change Thailand's economy and political structure. Kanpong Prayunsak is a Move Forward candidate in Bangkok. He told VOA in early April, "It's do or die. It's the old ways and powers versus change." The parties are competing against 2 parties led by former army chiefs involved in military takeovers. The newly formed United Thai Nation Party, or UTNP, led by Prime Minister Prayut, and the ruling Palang Pracharat Party, led by Prawit Wongsawan. Both parties get support from the urban middle classes. They are considered to represent the interests of Thailand's wealthy upper class and the military. The two groups have long influenced Thai politics. Another political party is Bumjai Thai. It has grown with its successful push to make Thailand Asia's first country to legalize the sale of cannabis. Voting ends at 10:00 UTC on Sunday. The Election Commission says unofficial results should be released that same evening. It aims to certify 95% of the votes within 60 days. The Commission and an alliance of media organizations are expected to provide updates on the vote count in the hours after voting stations close. It might be weeks, possibly months, before Thailand knows what its next government will look like, depending on the outcome of the election. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Think back to one of your favorite memories. What do you remember? Is it a time that you think about often? In this week's Everyday Grammar, we will share ways to talk about your memories, including verbal tenses and phrases that you can use to start talking about your memories. Let's take a trip down memory lane. This weekend is Mother's Day. I want to celebrate by remembering my mom, Ellen. She was a writer. When I was growing up, she would sit at the kitchen table with either a pen and paper or her typewriter. Now, when I sit down to write, I am reminded of my mom. The springtime also reminds me of her. She loved flowers. If my memory serves me right, she did not like red flowers. She loved yellow, pink, and white flowers. Now that spring is here, she is on my mind more. Let's look at some of the ways we can write about our memories. When we want to talk about our memories, we use the simple past tense. In the first paragraph about my mom, I use the simple past of the verb be. It is an irregular verb and has many forms. In the past tense, two forms are used, was and were. She was a writer. They were inspired by her writing. For regular verbs like love, we add the regular verb ending of ed. She loved flowers. We can also use would to talk in the past tense. Would can describe habitual actions in the past that are no longer done. Habitual means happening often or every day. She would sit at the kitchen table. Lastly, we use the auxiliary or helping verb do to make a negative sentence. The past tense form of do is did. She did not like red flowers. There are other verbs and phrases that we use to help us introduce those memories in conversation. The verb remind means to cause someone to remember someone or something. The sentence structure for remind is subject plus remind plus direct object plus preposition of. The springtime also reminds me of my mom. Springtime reminded me of her. We can also use remind in the passive voice to express that a memory came into our mind, or to say that we are reminded of something. I am reminded of my mom when I sit down to write. The sentence is passive because the agent, the who or what that reminded us, is missing. This works when we do not know the cause of what is acting on us. It is the opposite of the active voice, in which the cause of the action is known. We can use other phrases to introduce our memories. For example, in the second paragraph, I introduced more details using the phrase, "If my memory serves me right." This is an informal way to say, "if I remember correctly." In the last paragraph, I used the prepositional phrase, "on my mind." This is a figurative phrase, meaning that you are thinking or remembering someone or something. The structure is subject plus form of be plus on plus possessive pronoun plus mind. She is on my mind. Simple present tense. Today, we looked at different verbs, tenses, and phrases we can use to talk about our memories. Whether it is remembering loved ones or events, these phrases can help you talk about what you remember. Now for some homework. Use these verbs and phrases to share a memory. Remember to use the past tense. Is it a person you remember or an event that happened? Hopefully, it is a memory that you think about often. Write to us in the comments or send your memory message to learningenglish@voanews.com. We may share your message in a future Everyday Grammar. I'm Faith Perlow.
That was Faith Perlow with this week's Everyday Grammar. Welcome back, Faith.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be back.
This week you wrote about memories of your mom. Do you have any other favorite memories with her?
I do, Dan. Lots of memories of cooking with her and dancing around in the kitchen. She loved the oldies radio station. They played music from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. That was always on in the background.
That sounds like a fun time. You mentioned that she was a writer. What did she write?
It was always a fun time with her. She wrote a lot of poetry and also a book about her life and travels. She lived in many U.S. states and other countries like Germany and Iran. Do you have any fun memories of your mom or your parents growing up?
I remember when I was really little, I lost my favorite stuffed animal, and I was very sad about it. So, to cheer me up, my mom wrote me postcards from around the world from the stuffed animal, Pluto, to assure me he was okay. It was very sweet. It's always nice to reminisce.
That's a good word, reminisce. I did not get to cover that in this week's story. We use the verb reminisce when we talk about the act of remembering. Reminisce is a positive verb. So we use it when we think favorably about things from the past. For example, my mother reminisced often about her travels abroad.
Thanks for sharing a little bit more about your mom, Faith. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions. But during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a third world war. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them the Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Lindenborg. I came back the next day and I put little parachutes for the Galgumi and the Chocolaten so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings and boy, they waved their hands and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hand and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow. They were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.